Morning, Your Honor.
Mark Mistel for Mr. Crow, who was the defendant below, the appellant above. I was his trial counsel. This is a...
Reserve time, counsel.
3 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you. This case presents what I think may be an issue of first impression. It concerns the crime of unlawful use of a building for drug purposes. Mr. Crow had initially been charged with possession of a controlled substance or manufacturing a controlled substance based on marijuana found in an outbuilding on the property at which he lived with his longtime partner, Ms. Bryce. As the evidence was introduced, Mr. Crow provided information to establish that he was in a committed relationship with Ms. Bryce that spanned a significant period of time, that they had first lived together in his separate property and then had acquired this house essentially together, although Mr. Crow was the only one on the title. When the prosecutor amended the charge shortly before trial to the unlawful use of a building for drug purposes, our thought was that this crime could not be committed by one co-owner, where there was a separate co-owner who was growing the marijuana. So at the conclusion of our case, we submitted two jury instructions to Judge Kurtz, one basically setting out the definition of a committed and intimate relationship, to be able to argue that the essence of this crime is that the defendant controls the space and is making it available to someone else to commit a drug crime.
Isn't your argument essentially that it's legally impossible for a co-owner to make available the co-owned property to the co-owner?
That is my argument, Your Honor.
Okay. Isn't that a legal matter? Isn't that something for the judge to decide as opposed to the jury?
It's a legal matter, but I think in this situation we're dealing essentially with an equitable ownership. It was a question of fact of whether they had the requisite or have satisfied the requisite five factors to be deemed to be equitable co-owners.
Does your client's conduct with respect to the property play any role in his entitlement to the requested instructions?
I'm not sure I follow you, Judge.
Well, your client didn't just sit back while someone else who had a right, arguably, to manage the property did something. He actively participated, and even by his own admission.
Absolutely.
Why doesn't that eliminate the argument that you're making?
I think it would eliminate the argument I was making if they had prosecuted him as initially charged, that he was constructively in possession of marijuana in excess of what's authorized through medical marijuana. I'm not sure I see why his affirmative action in wiring the outbuilding so that the marijuana could be grown or acquiescing to the fact that there was marijuana start plants in the basement made him guilty of unlawfully furnishing this building for drug purposes.
Your argument is that this building is under equal management authority of two different people.
That's correct, that it's owned by two different people.
Okay. He would still then have a building that is under his management. It's just shared management. And he did make it available, didn't he, since he was wiring and constructing?
No, he was aiding and abetting the crime of unlawful manufacture of marijuana.
Well,
once we got past
that as well, but explain to me why wiring it and building enclosures is not making it a part of or evidence of making it available.
Because he didn't have the right to exclude her. And to me, making it available presupposes that you have the right to exclude the other person. If they're equal co-owners, then he doesn't have the right to exclude her. She has the same interest in the property that he has.
So I can't make something available to you if you already have a right to use it? Is that the essence of your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. You can facilitate my possession of it.
Do things. For example, you and your significant other co-own a car. She comes up to the car one night and it's got a flat tire and she doesn't have the physical ability to change it. You go out and change the tire. Are you making the car available to her?
I'm making the car capable of moving, which is something that you apparently think she couldn't do on her own.
Well, I've asked you to assume that she can't.
Okay. Assuming that she can't, I'm not making the car available to her. I'm making the ability of the car to move available to her. She still has the right to get in the car. She still has the right to call a mechanic to fix the car. She still has the right, potentially, to do whatever she wants with the car. I would agree with you if I had the right then to say you can't go in the car and somehow that had some lawful authority, and that's a situation I think Mr. Crow was in. He did not have the right to say you can't do that.
Does she have the right to destroy the car?
No, she does not have the right to destroy the car because she would then be destroying property of another.
And isn't that similar to what's happening here with Ms. Bryce? I mean, was she not putting Mr. Crow in the position of losing the property his share of that property or his ownership interest in there?
She was potentially putting him in jeopardy because the house was seized for forfeiture purposes. However, if you look at State versus Coria, they're talking about the legislature having enacted legislation that abrogated the common law, and that's why co-owners of property could be prosecuted successfully for malicious mischief.
Could one co-owner seek relief from a court to enjoin illegal use of the property by a co-owner?
I believe they could.
Why isn't that an available means to exclude an illegal use?
I think that is an available means. I think the policy question is this how you want the statute to apply? Or is this statute really designed to stop kind of absentee people from allowing crimes to be committed knowingly on their property?
Was this a question of statutory intent? Is that?
I think with the evolving change in how committed couples are being treated, I think it is kind of a policy argument and legislative intent. Did they intend that two people who were essentially, in their minds, co-owning property, going to be held criminally responsible for each other simply because they acquiesce?
Well, your client did more than acquiesce.
Well, yes, he did more than acquiesce, but he thought it was going to be a legitimate medical marijuana drug. Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court, I'm Seth Fine, representing Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for Snohomish County, representing the respondent, the state of Washington. The defendant's claim that he thought that this was a lawful medical marijuana operation was presented to the jury under instructions that are not challenged on appeal. In fact, they were instructions that were given on defense request over the state's opposition. And the jury clearly did not believe the defendant's testimony in that regard. The issue on this appeal that deals with two instructions dealing with a so-called meretricious relationship. And there are fundamentally three reasons why these instructions were properly refused. And they form kind of a circle ranging from the narrower grounds to the broadest grounds. The narrowest grounds, which are nonetheless entirely sufficient to uphold the rejection of these instructions, is that they didn't say anything that was relevant to the jury's task. They defined a so-called meretricious relationship. They stated that such a relationship gave rise to rights of a co-owner, but they didn't say anything about how the girlfriend's purported co-ownership status related to the elements of the offense. The to convict instruction talked about the defendant having control of the property of owner and didn't say anything at all about what effect the ownership rights would be of somebody else. So these instructions, as proposed, stated abstract propositions of law with no relationship to the case. To make these instructions appropriate, even if we accept the defendant's legal theory overall, these instructions required a third one, one saying, for example, as he's argued today, that if Ms. Bryce was a co-owner, the defendant could not be convicted. But no such instruction was proposed, and the court was not under a duty to write one. And for that reason, ultimately, the court need not decide the legal propositions being advanced by the defendant since they weren't set out in any appropriate jury instruction. The second broader issue has to do with...
Before you move on to the second one, would you think that was an accurate statement of the law if, in fact, this was a committed relationship, that if the jury found that to be the case, the defendant could not be convicted?
No, I would not, which ultimately is the third and broadest proposition that the...
Why don't you go to your other ones, then?
Okay. Yeah, well, then let me just briefly address the middle proposition, which has to do, which really has nothing to do with this statute, but has to do with the law of committed intimate relationships. The proposition is that a committed intimate relationship gives rise to a tenancy in common, co-ownership, and the case authority is clear that it does not. This issue was squarely addressed by Division 3 in the Kelly and Moslang case, which was decided in the context of statute of limitations on a civil action, but ultimately the issue was the same. The partner out of possession there claimed that she was a tenant in common, a co-owner, and if she was correct, then the statute of limitations doesn't run. Co-ownership rights could lie dormant for decades with the owner in possession making full use of every part of the property, the statute of limitations doesn't begin to run until there's an affirmative act of ouster. Division 3 rejected that analysis, said that there wasn't co-ownership rights, there was merely a right of equitable contribution, which had to be asserted, which arose and had to be asserted by when the relationship terminated. So, you know, basically, when this a suit is brought to enforce these rights, you know, the outcome of the suit is not likely to be both parties equally owning every piece of property that was acquired during the relationship. The outcome is likely to be, as in dissolution actions, the court making some equitable distribution. It, in fact, you know, it is possible that the court may say, this house will be awarded to both the people as tenants in common. It is far more likely that the court will award it to one or the other and award some compensatory assets or award a future right of contribution subject to a lien. So the proposition that if there was a committed intimate relationship, they are co-owners of every piece of property is, as a matter of law, incorrect. He was still the owner of the house. He still had the right to exclude her from the house. By doing so, he would probably terminate the relationship, thereby giving right to quite possibly a suit for contribution. But they were not tenants in common, even if this committed intimate relationship existed. And that then brings me to the final point, which is that co-ownership doesn't have anything to do with this. The statute is very specific. The defendant must have control of the property. He must have it in certain capacities, including ownership, and he must make it available for illegal drug purposes. You know, in this case, the jury was instructed that that means he has to know that the purposes are illegal. This statute clearly does apply to situations where the person in possession, the person actually growing the drugs, has a legal right of occupancy. And that is the case, for example, in a landlord-tenant relationship.
Is knowledge and acquiescence sufficient on the part of the owner?
The statute appears to require something more. It requires...
What does make available mean?
That's a little hard to say. It's different language than is used in other statutes. There are other statutes, the permitting prostitution statute, for example, which talks about acquiescence, permission, where knowledge and acquiescence is clearly sufficient. This appears to contemplate the affirmative act of putting the person in position to use the property, not
so
merely
acquiring and dividing into rooms would be enough.
It would be enough, yes, and some lesser things could be enough. You know, but consider the typical landlord-tenant situation. You know, while the tenancy is in effect, the tenant actually has rights greater than that of the landlord, the owner. The tenant has a right of exclusive possession, has a right to exclude the landlord, which right a co-owner does not have, and yet clearly the statute applies in this situation if the other elements are satisfied. You know, The peculiar thing about the co-ownership situation is that both persons have an equal right to use the property. So, for example, take the example that was discussed earlier, the question of two people who are co-ownership of the of an automobile. Well, if one person wishes to use the property to go buy groceries, let's say, the other person can prevent that by saying that they want to use the property to go to a baseball game. Or in this situation, excluding the illegal nature of the use and assuming that they were co-owners, then Ms. Bryce had a right to use the garage for growing tomatoes, and the defendant had an equal right to use the garage for storing vehicles.
Does anyone ever have a right to devote property to an illegal use?
No, they do not. And in fact, that invokes the one of the key limitations on the rights of a co-owner. You cannot use the property in a way that threatens or impairs the other co-owner's legal interest, which using the property for growing drugs clearly does, because it separates this from forfeiture. So, I mean, even if she had a legal use in mind, like growing tomatoes, and even if they were co-owners, the defendant could, in fact, have prevented that simply by asserting his own right to use the property for some other inconsistent purpose. Once they're at loggerheads like that, only a court could resolve the dispute, probably by partition. But even apart from that, you know, even if he didn't choose to use something else, she had no right to use it for an illegal purpose, such as especially growing a controlled substance. By doing so, she threatened his ownership rights. You know, he could prevent that, if nothing else, by the simple expedient of contacting police, which is something that this statute explicitly refers to and explicitly makes a defense.
And in this case, the jury was permitted to determine whether he believed that this was a legal grow operation.
That's correct. Under the instructions as given to the jury, if he believed that the operation was legal, whether it was or not, he was entitled to acquittal. Or if they had a reasonable doubt on that topic, he was entitled to acquittal. The proposed instructions were properly refused. This judgment should be affirmed.
The reason the instructions were requested was to allow us to argue our theory of the case, once again, that both parties had the same right of use of the property. The issue of whether Ms. Bryce's illegal use of the property is relevant to prosecution under this statute, I think, is not the issue. Clearly, she threatened his right of ownership by subjecting the property to forfeiture. Clearly, he has a potential to defend against that had he been an innocent owner. And once again, the issue of how he thought the property was being used may be germane to the forfeiture issue. However, whether or not it threatened his right of ownership doesn't necessarily coalesce into the fact that he's guilty of making something available to her. And I disagree that by wiring or doing carpentry work or watering made it available to her.
What do you think making available means?
I mean, I think it means giving someone access that they otherwise would not be entitled to have, as opposed to equating making available with facilitating the use. Clearly, he facilitated her ability to start what he considered to be a medicinal marijuana grow. He did not make the space available to her any more than he would have made a bathroom in the house available to her. If the toilet was running or leaking,
he testified that he disagreed with her decision to use the premises for this purpose. They argued about it. She won the argument, and then they agreed to go forward.
Correct.
Why would that not be sufficient to establish that he's making it available? He seemed to think that he had an ability to say no. That's why they argued about it, because he tried to tell her no.
Well, don't all partners have the ability to share opinions and argue about the outcome?
But then they agreed.
And then they agreed. Right. But does that mean that she didn't have the right simply because he didn't want her to do it?
Well, the question is, did he make it available? And did, and by agreeing to do so, did he make it available?
And once again, my position is, if she had the right of possession, if she's an equitable co-owner, it was her right to use the property as she
what
wished.
What does his agreement mean?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
His agreement to do, that's insignificant?
I think the agreement simply shows that they were in a committed, intimate relationship where they're trying to work out their disagreements between them. I don't think that it means that had he said you're not doing that, that she couldn't have done it anyway. I guess the recourse could be that he could have gone to the court and sought partition or something. But once again,
he could have called the police.
Or he could have called the police.
Now, obviously and, that has an impact on the relationship.
Not only does it have an impact on the relationship, but it has an impact on his liberty. Right. The police then would have to accept the fact that the marijuana that was growing there, he had nothing to do with. Thank you, judges.
Thank you, counsel. Next matter is state